You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Scott Lamar. During the coronavirus pandemic, we've been reminded from time to time that thousands of people are still dying across the country from drug overdoses. Often the deaths are attributed to and listed as part of the opioid epidemic. Best-selling author Sam Quiñones writes in his new book that we as a nation are in a new era, and one that is dominated by the deadly synthetic drug fentanyl, as well as a new generation of methamphetamine that is driving those who use it to what looks very much like mental illness. New York Times best-selling author Sam Quiñones appears on today's Smart Talk to offer perspective in his latest book. It's called The Least of Us: True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. Sam Quiñones, welcome to the program. In your book, you write that we are in a new era of fentanyl and meth. Why do you say that?
Well, it's really because down in Mexico, they have seen the remarkable benefit from a trafficker's perspective of switching away from plant-based drugs and producing those drugs instead synthetically in a lab with chemicals, no plant involved. The benefits to the trafficking world are what's at stake here, really. That's why this has happened. It has really very little to do with the customers, the demand side of this question. From a trafficker point of view, with synthetic drugs, you don't need land. You don't need sunlight, seasons, you don't need irrigation, farmers, you can produce everything in a lab away from the prying gaze of helicopters. Crucially, if you have connections, if you have control of ports, you can get as much of the world chemical market as you need to make the drugs all year round. And that's exactly what's happened in Mexico. It's no longer land that's important, it's shipping ports, and they control two of them on the western side of Mexico, in which they get container loads of precursors, chemicals that can go into making fentanyl and making methamphetamine. What that means is, crucially for us, is that they can make these drugs all year round and in quantities that simply boggle the mind. They've never seen the quantities that we're seeing today.
So when you say that this is not consumer driven, would the consumer, those who are using fentanyl and those who are using methamphetamine, would they choose those two synthetic drugs if they had the choice?
Well, addiction means you kind of don't have the choice. Your brain is completely dominated. It's a brainwashing. I think it's kind of one of the best ways to describe it. It's a brainwashing that really denies you really rational, free choice. And so I think the trafficking world fully understands that part of the equation as well. And so, the people oftentimes, in my view, don't really have that choice. Initially, of course, they do. But once you're addicted, the drugs of abuse really kind of suppress all impulses that really work to keep us alive. And they end up working, the brain ends up working in favor of continued drug abuse, as if drugs are our life and drugs are what we need. And so I don't believe that that's actually the consumer on the other end has much choice, and I think also traffickers understand that.
In your book, The Least of Us, you write a lot about how these substances and other substances, the effects that they have on the brain. So getting back to what you're saying about, about my question of whether those consumers would choose these drugs, what effects do fentanyl and methamphetamine have on the brain? What kind of high? What do the consumers of those drugs get out of them?
In the case of fentanyl, fentanyl is an opioid, like heroin, like the oxycodone and hydrocodone. It's just extraordinarily potent, much more so than morphine or heroin or all the rest. And so there's a euphoria that comes along with it. And also, of course, if you're already addicted, say, to pain pills or to heroin, fentanyl will satisfy those withdrawal symptoms, the dope sickness that may come, so you can avoid that. That's a big an important reason why folks continue to have to really use everyday opioids when they're addicted, because it's to keep that dope sickness away. Fentanyl does that as well. It's just extraordinarily potent, and therefore it's very easy to get a dose of fentanyl that is way too much than your tolerance can handle. When it comes to the methamphetamine that is currently circulating out of Mexico on the streets of the United States, it is very often accompanied by severe symptoms of mental illness. People begin using it for a variety of reasons. I think sometimes because it's very, very prevalent, it's cheaper than ever. There is sometimes a slight euphoria with it. I think a lot of people who are already addicted to one drug like opioids switch to methamphetamine because they think, well, maybe it won't kill me. I won't overdose in the technical way that you do on opioids. And they get into it that way. But eventually what ends up happening, I think very often, is that this drug is accompanied by symptoms of mental illness, hallucinations, very severe paranoia that last and last and last. And that frequently also they end up homeless. So why would you use methamphetamine frequently? It's because it's so prevalent. And there's this feeling, I think, in neuroscience now, for a while now, that once you're addicted to one drug, it's like any other drug will kind of do. And I think that what you're seeing now on the streets is very much that. You're seeing people using methamphetamine, also marijuana, also other drugs, Xanax, benzodiazepines, and so on. But the methamphetamine seems to be accompanied very strongly by these symptoms of mental illness.
And I want to talk about the effects on the brain and something you had just mentioned about once you're addicted to one substance that I won't say it becomes easy, but it is easier to become addicted to another. But something you just said, and I just want to clarify, provide a little history lesson here. Meth used to be considered a party drug. And many people, when they start with today's methamphetamine, they may think it still is a party drug. But from what you're describing, it is much different than the methamphetamine of just a few years ago.
Right. And that's because of the way let me put it this way. Yes, there is a meth that's made in a different way coming out of Mexico today. And that changed about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, really, in Mexico. The reasons why this is happening, the neuroscientific reasons, the effects on the brain have not been studied. So I'm not here to tell you I actually know why this is going on. I'm here to report, though, that my reporting, talking with drug counselors, shelter providers, recovering addicts, police officers, et cetera, all these folks who have a firsthand experience with this, is that absolutely meth was a party drug at one point. It was something you wanted to be around people. Now the meth that's coming out of Mexico is very much the opposite. It's very kind of a solitary thing, very sends you into a shell very quickly. You're talking in strange ways. You're not making any sense. You're seeing very scary hallucinations, and everybody around you seems to be a threat, a menace to you, looking to kill you or something like this. It's a common thing that's accompanying this methamphetamine. Not always. I wouldn't say always. I've met people who say hasn't affected them that way, but certainly I would say that those numbers are outnumbered considerably by the folks who report these kinds of symptoms and that extraordinarily difficult as well after people stop using for the personality to return. It does take a long time for that to happen.
What is P2P? You write about it in The Least of Us.
Yes, P2P is a precursor in one method of making methamphetamine. It was not the way they used to make methamphetamine down in Mexico for many years, and is actually the most efficient way of making methamphetamine, which is using a chemical known as ephedrine. Ephedrine is a decongestant. You find it in Sudafed pills. It's been controlled in the United States, which is why you can't get decongestants anywhere but behind a lock and key at like Walgreens and Costco and so on. But in 2008, after the Mexican trafficking world had effectively industrialized production of methamphetamine using the ephedrine method and was getting tons of it coming into Mexico and could then produce tons of meth, the Mexican government made it illegal, except for a few pharmaceutical companies, to possess. And when that happened, the trafficking world had to switch to another way. The other way they found was an old way, very inefficient, not a way you'd really want to use, except that it allowed for the use of a wide variety of chemicals that you were no longer bottlenecked by the use of just one. The precursor in this is a chemical known as P2P. Phenol 2 propanone. And the benefit to the trafficking world of this method is that there are many, many, many ways of making P2P. It's not one way. Governments have very difficult time regulating it. These chemicals are industrial, they're legal, and they're used in many, many different industries. They are very toxic as well. And so the Mexican trafficking world, beginning in 2009, but really amping up in, say, 2012, 13, 14, that's when you really begin to see the trafficking world down in Mexico begin to produce quantities of methamphetamine that really, in the end, within about 6 or 8 years, cover the entire United States. With ephedrine-based meth, Mexican traffickers could not really supply more than really what would cover the parts of the Western United States. Never went east of the Mississippi River. Now the methamphetamine is way beyond the Mississippi River. It's up into New England. It's up into New York. It's up into Pennsylvania and North Carolina, et cetera. Areas where really you never saw Mexican made meth until a few years ago when they switched to this new method using the precursor P2P.
And you touched on this just a few minutes ago, but you attribute much of the homelessness that we have in this country to the proliferation of this meth, right?
There's many reasons why people go homeless, and there's a lot, and it could have to do with economics, with housing prices, and so on. However, I think that, yes, that there is a very strong connection, very strong correlation between the homelessness that is out there today, particularly the very visible tent encampment homelessness that you see in many cities, but now, of course, in many rural areas and many suburban areas. I believe this is very strongly connected to the P2P. It's kind of accompanied by the P2P-based meth that's been coming out of Mexico in the last several years. The P2P meth. And very quickly renders people impossible to live with, you know, screaming at 3 a.m, terrified of what's under the bed, using, you know, knives to stab the wall. You can't live with folks like that. What's more, those folks very often are not able to live in homeless shelters either, because the homeless shelters are filled with people that terrify them. Meth has turned the world into this very menacing place, scary place. That is why I believe the tents have become such a popular thing, that because the tents offer people who are on methamphetamine a perfect place, a solitary lodging, where you can stay away, get away from the world all by yourself in your own little kind of world. Your brain is alone, and so on. That's not the only reason people use tents, of course. However, when you get down into tent encampments, particularly in the places I visited, it's very clear that a lot of those tents are occupied by people who are suffering from severe mental symptoms of schizophrenia and very often induced by this methamphetamine. There are a lot of ways of going homeless in this country today, in this economy today, but I would say that this is certainly a major driver of it.
Let's switch over to fentanyl a little bit. When you say that we are in a new era, one of the striking parts of that is that there have been so many overdose deaths, often attributed to opioids. Fentanyl is an opioid, but that the overdoses are caused by too much fentanyl. In fact, you go as far as saying that the most overdose death, or the biggest overdose death toll in the nation's history. That is saying a lot.
Well, I think it's true. I think the numbers bear that out, that it's really fentanyl is now driving these record numbers of overdose deaths all across the country, really, because fentanyl is now remarkably covering the entire country. With synthetic drugs, it's fascinating. The drug world has been able to replicate what corporate America has done. You know, if you go set out on a trip across the country from L.A. to, say, the East Coast, all along the way, you will see the same hotels, the same offering of fast food and gas stations and so on. It's a strange thing, but in the first time in the history of drug trafficking with synthetic drugs on the quantities that they're able to produce, the amount, the offering is really the same pretty much all across the country, or becoming the same all across the country. It's fentanyl, it's methamphetamine, it's meth mixed with fentanyl. And fentanyl is such a potent drug, but the problem with it is, in order for the traffickers and dealers on the street to make the profit that they know they can make with the stuff, they have to mix it. They have to mix it with powders that don't do anything, but you can't just sell such a few grains of what amounts to a few grains of salt almost. You can't sell that. It's not easy to market. So you have to mix it with a lot of other stuff. Then you can package it and sell it. The problem is they don't know very well how to package this, how to mix it. They're very bad at that, and they probably don't care too much either. And so you're never going to survive. There's no such thing, I believe, as a long-term street user of fentanyl in America today. You eventually will die, because no matter what your tolerance level has risen to using fentanyl, whether you know you're using it or not, there will come a time when the mix just doesn't match up, and you will get something that's just a little bit too potent, and you'll overdose. Many people have overdosed over and over, and just have been revived by people who happen to be nearby, or by paramedics or what have you. But it's a very, very delicate process, and there's not a lot delicate about the street trafficking world.
What percentage of opioids that are sold on the street today do you think are mixed with fentanyl?
Oh, huge. I wouldn't know offhand, and I think it does depend on what region you happen to be in. But I think here's the thing. There is no way. We've reached the end, the very end of the idea of recreational drug use. There is no way that you can know if you are buying a baggie of what's called heroin, or what's called methamphetamine, or what's called cocaine, or a pill from getting a pill from a friend, a pain pill. Yeah, take this. There is absolutely no way you can know that stuff doesn't have fentanyl in it. There are strips. People, you can test that. What we're finding now is that the strips are being used by people who are already addicted to fentanyl to make sure that the drug has fentanyl in it, because they can't not have fentanyl now. They're addicted to something that is very high tolerance, has brought their tolerance up very high. And so heroin won't do it anymore. So what you're seeing now is fentanyl is really crowding out heroin. In a few years, I don't think we'll see any heroin on the streets of America. It'll all be fentanyl. And then it becomes, again, a nationwide crapshoot. What you get. You can test with fentanyl test strips, but again, people who are addicted to it are frequently using those test strips to make sure that what they're buying has fentanyl in it.
Wanted to follow up on something you just described. There are even pills that are pressed with fentanyl in it today?
Correct. This was a move down in Mexico. It began in really 2017. The first seizures were that year. And what began to happen was the trafficking world in Mexico began to understand that they could make more money if they simply pressed this fentanyl into pills. And so they began to replicate, make phony counterfeit versions of Percocets, Xanax, what other ones? Oxycodone, generic 30 milligrams, or several of these pills that are made down in Mexico now that have pharmaceutical markings, look just like what you might buy in a pharmacy, yet all they have is fentanyl in them. They don't have any other active ingredient. And this allowed them, I think, access to two things. First of all, it allowed them access to people who had grown addicted to pain pills during the opioid epidemic, and now we're finding it harder to get those pills. So all of a sudden you come along with these, and they're like, okay, Fine, I'll do that. What that does, though, is take their tolerance again up to very high levels. They need a lot of that stuff every day to keep the dope sickness away. The other thing that that does was really, I think, gain the trafficking world access to our American love affair with pills that dates to really, I think, Valium in 1960s. We have had that love affair for pills, thinking it's their, you know, convenient, easy solutions, very acceptable. You know, pull a pill out at a party, and you've got nobody is going to be aghast at anything like that. So we have this love affair, and they have never been able to take advantage of it in the trafficking world until fentanyl. Fentanyl allows them to kind of mix these things, press these things using pill presses that you can find very easily on the internet, and begin to produce. Now what has happened, though, is that they are just producing millions and millions of these pills. They just busted one lab in Mexico, in the city of Culiacan, which is in the state of Sinaloa, the big trafficking state in Mexico. In this one lab, they seized 118 kilos of fentanyl. And they estimated, the military down there estimated, that the lab was probably able to produce 70 kilos of fentanyl a month. And that means that's roughly 70 million of those pills. That's just one lab. So you're seeing tens of millions of these pills come in into the United States from Mexico. And frequently now, see, the fascinating thing, Scott, is I think that the supply has solved the age old dilemma for the drug dealer on the street. The big dilemma for the drug dealer on the street was, where do I get my dope? How do I get the dope that'll make me the money I need? It was very difficult. People would get arrested, get sent to prison, all that stuff. That you'd constantly have to find a new connection. The supplies now on the street have solved that dilemma. They've said, now you can get this stuff anywhere. Now the big question is, where do you sell it all? Particularly during COVID, when nobody's on the street and that kind of thing. Well, one place that really became kind of the new street corner was social media apps, where people were selling these anonymously on Snapchat, on Instagram, TikTok, gaming platforms, various places like that, and then delivering it because they knew the customers that they had couldn't go outside. Frequently, the customers were kids who were on their phones in high school and what have you. And so the pills that they begun producing in 2017 have reached, again, just glut proportions now.
You know, you write in the book that the opioid epidemic was something that impacted mostly the white community. And that's one of the reasons that it has gotten so much attention over the last decade or so. But you also write that fentanyl has changed that. In what way?
Well, it's largely created the first widespread cases of African Americans overdosing from opioids. Before, exactly as you say, when I was writing Dreamland, this was a uniracial problem, it seemed to me. Most of the folks involved were white. Blacks, Latinos, not so much really at all. But with fentanyl, that has changed, particularly in the Black community, where dealers have figured out that if they add their fentanyl, which is very cheap, to cocaine, which is really in the Black community, among drug users in the Black community, the most popular drug is cocaine. If they add fentanyl to cocaine, they get a couple of benefits. One is, on the street, word spreads that they've got this kind of new bump to this drug that has come up from Colombia. Remember, it's all made in Colombia, and cocaine is, and it's been diluted along the way significantly. And so now it's gotten a new potency with fentanyl. But also, I think the benefit to traffickers and dealers really on the street is that once you lace your cocaine a little bit with fentanyl, pretty soon you have an opioid addict, not a cocaine user who will buy from you every 2 or 3 days. Opioid addicts have to buy from you every single day to keep the dope sickness away. The problem is, not a lot of people have known that that's happening in their area, or not know what they have in there and what they've just purchased. And a lot of people using cocaine have died of fentanyl overdoses. And this is really a big deal now in all across the country because people of all races use cocaine. But in the Black community, it's really marks the first time that large numbers of African Americans have been dying in the opioid epidemic from what is an opioid, even though they thought that they were using cocaine. This is happening really pretty much coast to coast, I think.
I noticed you haven't mentioned China in relationship to fentanyl. And there was a time where we heard so much about fentanyl being imported in, or coming into the United States from China. What's China's role, if any, at this point?
Great question. Yes, initially, 2013, 14, 15, right in there, most of the supplies were coming from China. They were being mailed through the mail, lost in the mail, kind of just among the millions and millions of packages that come into the U.S. every day. They were going to folks' houses and they were being mixed badly. And that's why you began to see, these overdoses in clusters. You remember maybe in 2015 and 16, 50 overdoses in a weekend in a few blocks in Cincinnati or in Huntington, West Virginia. This would go on across the country, and it was largely because China was sending fentanyl powder to folks in the United States who really did not know what they were doing when they were mixing this stuff with other powders to be able to sell it. In fact, in my book, one of the chapters is about how the myth kind of spread that the best way to mix this stuff, fentanyl, with other powders was with a magic bullet blender, the kind that you get at Target for $29.95, which I own myself. It's a magnificent little machine for making salsa and smoothies and all that stuff. It's really, really deficient and not the thing that should be used to mix a deadly drug like fentanyl. Yet people were using it. They were using coffee grinders. It was really, really kind of like a kind of a Wild West kind of thing. And so people were dying. Well, then in 2000, and a big customer of China back then was Mexican traffickers in Mexico. They would buy a lot of that stuff and then they would ship it up here and make money off it that way. But in 2000, I believe it was 19. The Chinese government put a restriction on fentanyl, allowing only a few companies to make it. However, what is happening now is that they are not shipping fentanyl, certainly anything like what they were four or five years ago, but they are shipping the ingredients, and the main customer in our hemisphere, I think, for those ingredients is the trafficking world in Mexico, where they now know how to make fentanyl. So they don't need to buy it from the Chinese anymore. They can just buy the ingredients. But the enormous quantities, again, to get back to the supply, the enormous quantities of these ingredients allows for just simply the coverage of the entire continental United States and into Hawaii and Alaska too, I'm quite sure, of fentanyl.
You've touched on this, but one of the most interesting aspects of the book, The Least of Us, is that you delve into the neuroscience of addiction. And I'm going to read a quote here, conclude that we live in a soup of legal substances and services whose addictiveness is ever refined by consumer product corporations. You give some examples and you use sugar as an example. Talk a little bit about that science, that neuroscience.
Yeah, it's fascinating, Scott. Really, we are in an era of what I would say is really the golden age of neuroscience research. It's remarkable what we know about the brain and the questions we're able to ask now. Not me, I'm a layman. I'm learning from all these brilliant neuroscientists we have around here in our country today. It's really a remarkable discipline. Where there's a lot to learn, but certainly we know a whole lot more than we did, say, even 15, 20 years ago. I wanted to write about in my book the idea that yes, we have these very potent drugs coming in, but we have all around us all these drugs that are these things that are addictive, services and substances, as you say, that are addictive all around us. And a big one was sugar. I was very lucky to speak with a woman, a very bright, sharp woman who's been doing this for a lot of years, Nicole Avena. Nicole was very helpful. She's a neuroscientist at Princeton, and she was one of a grad student when they were doing lots of tests on how can we establish a scientific basis for the idea that sugar may be addictive to the human brain. And they studied this in rats, sugar-dependent rats, and found that, you know, yes, that when you give some sugar-dependent rats, when you get them dependent on sugar, pretty soon nothing else will work. Water without sugar won't work. You can even give, this is fascinating, I thought, they did a study where they gave the rats naloxone. Now, naloxone, for your listeners who may not know, is the antidote to an overdose on heroin, or fentanyl or all the other opioids. So you give naloxone to a person who's overdosing, and that person comes back to life, revives, really is saved from death. That person will likely enter withdrawals, be very skittish and want more dope, because it's just, he's really in need of dope now because he's had it removed from his receptors. Well, what they found in rats, when sugar-dependent rats were given naloxone, just the way any paramedic would give to an overdosing person on the street, those rats also showed signs of withdrawals, the ways that neuroscientists have been able to kind of quantify that. And so they're, you know, very anxious, shivering, doing wet dog shake, you know, shaking constantly, that kind of thing. Once you give a sugar-dependent rat naloxone, he enters into the withdrawal symptoms is similar to what happens to a heroin addict after he is revived. So the idea was to say, you know, we may reserve our outrage for the drug trafficker, but I have to say that the drug trafficker is simply in a long continuum that includes the Facebook design, software designer, fast food manufacturers, soda manufacturers, casino designers, porno makers, video game, all these things are legal, and they are all priming us for addiction. And at the end, you get the Sinaloa drug cartel, right? You get but all of this, we live in this soup, in this toxic soup of things that are constantly being refined, made more potent actors on our brain. And I think has a lot to do. Our brains really evolved and have not changed in millions of years, but all the offerings all around us most certainly have.
I'm just curious, with the people that you spoke with, when you say that those who were dependent on sugar had the same reaction when given naloxone as someone who was addicted to an opioid, does that mean that someone who is addicted to, say, sugar or gambling or pornography, that person is more susceptible to being addicted to another substance?
I think that's possible. I think there's not a way of saying that that's certainty. It's just by way of saying that we live in a culture in which our brains are constantly being plied with substances or services that will lead to kind of a perversion in the way we behave towards them, I guess, is the way. There's a lot of other things. And addiction is a fascinating topic, and we're still learning a lot about it because, of course, it involves the brain, central nervous system, and so on. And so there's a lot of things that go into that. A lot of it has to do with environment. A lot of it, I believe, has to do as well with trauma. So just because we may have a fascination or an impulse to constantly eat sugary sweet things does not mean, of course, we're just going to automatically become an opioid addict or something like that. But it's a way of thinking about how these substances and services hit our brain, and also thinking about what we can do about it. See, to me, all of this allows us liberty. Freedom in a way of saying, I can move beyond this. I've got all this arrayed against me. And so now I can make decisions, say, with regard to, say, sugar or fast food or pornography, that kind of thing, that these are not so powerfully addicting that I lose rational free choices, say, might happen with methamphetamine or so on. And that once you know this, once you have this information, this is what happened with me. I began to understand these kinds of things, and I just stopped drinking soda. I used to drink a lot of Coca-Cola. I just stopped doing that. I started getting more exercise, understanding that exercise was very good for the brain and good for almost everything, of course. It's the great medicine that we have available to us constantly. And so Learning this, though, it seemed to me allowed me a kind of a liberty, an ability to act as a free individual instead of being kind of plied by forces I wasn't quite aware of or maybe didn't understand the potency. It was a strange revelation to me that as I began to study this, and I decided, okay, I can make use of this in my own daily life. I can just stop buying sugary stuff. I can remove it from the house, that kind of thing. That's kind of what happened.
You also tell the story of the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma and their one and only product, oxycodone. First of all, why did you include that as part of the book? And the Sackler family story is a fascinating one, too.
Yes, I included it in there because, first of all, Dreamland had a lot about that family and Purdue Pharma, the company they own. And I thought a lot had happened. You know, one of the amazing things about Dreamland is when I was writing it and turned it in, I had this feeling this book was going to go nowhere because nobody wanted to talk about it. And at the time, too, there were only three lawsuits against these drug companies. Well, Dreamland comes out and awareness begins to spread and all this. And after a while, the number of lawsuits multiplies. And so today you have something on the order of 2,600. You went from three lawsuits to 2,600 lawsuits trying to pry money from drug companies. Well, along with that are lawsuits brought by attorneys general across the country. I think every single attorney general in the United States now has a lawsuit that involves Purdue Pharma, other drug companies as well. What that brings, though, is they have subpoena power. They have very talented, experienced investigators and prosecutors working for them, and they have been able to subpoena enormous kinds of records. And so there's from Purdue and from the other companies. And so what you are seeing over the last several years is a divulging of really the documents that tell a much fuller story of all that went on. And I didn't have room in this book to tell everything there was to say about it, but I wanted to add some of it. And so I focused on the criminal the complaints brought against the Purdue and the Sackler family by both the Attorney General in Tennessee and the Attorney General in Massachusetts. And all of that was just, you know, they have these long, long complaints quoting internal emails, memoranda, studies that the company, did. All of this kind of stuff, it just allowed for a huge divulging of the full story, which shows, frankly, that more of the same, really, that the Sacklers seemed, I say this in the book, they seemed almost as addicted to money and didn't really care how they got it, just pushing their sales force to sell more and more and push doctors to prescribe more and more of OxyContin, regardless of the situation the doctor found himself in or the patients or anything. And that this actually there was some connection or some resemblance, it seemed to me, a resemblance to the way drug addicts behave when it comes to their drug. It's like endlessly, nothing else will do. I've got to have more and more. And some is, you know, nothing's ever enough. And so that was kind of the reasons I told some of the story that had been divulged through these subpoenas about the Sacklers and the least of us.
You know, one of the most shocking parts of that is that, I mean, there was a conscious decision to keep people addicted to oxycodone and, if anything, to increase how much of it they were taking. I mean, no caring whatsoever about the patient. It was just make more money, right?
It seemed to be the case. Certainly, they wouldn't talk to me, so I don't know. But you know, they have denied all. I want to make it very clear they've denied all personal responsibility, the individual Sacklers, and all this. And so, you know, that's what their perspective is. That's fine. But yes, they had this idea that any street drug dealer knows too, that you keep someone on whatever it is you're selling, and that person will the longer they're on, the longer they're going to be on, you know, that there's a point to keeping people on a drug, because and then upping the dose, the more you can up the dose, the more tolerance they have. And this was always the push from the Purdue Pharma sales force. They were always taught, get doctors to up the dose constantly. The more you can get doctors to up the dose, the better chance that that patient will be on that, will be using that pill, that OxyContin 5 years from now. And there's a lot of studies showing that. And they really put that idea into practice, which, as I say, is a concept I would suggest that many drug dealers on the street pretty much understand. Mm.
You know, if someone listening to our conversation today and maybe thinking what the book is about, they may come away depressed or at least sad. But one of the things that you consciously do in the book, in fact, it's even in the title, The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth, is that you write that there is reason to hope out there. In what way?
Well, I think what this is showing us, the opioid epidemic, when I was writing Dreamland, I definitely came away with this idea. And I think it's just more so today that first of all, this is showing us certain essential things that we need to keep in mind and act on. First of all, that we are only as strong as the most vulnerable, that we are only as strong as the least of us, hence the title. Right. And the idea of being, I'm not a Christian, but I was reading the Bible during writing this book. And I read Book of Matthew, and Jesus talks about that, what you do for the least of my brethren, you do for me. And it seemed to me that this was a message that was very potent in this day and age, certainly also with the pandemic, frankly, as well, you know. And so I began to think along those lines. I also began to understand that we have, that this may be awakening us to the idea that we have really shredded or lost in over the last 40 years of the importance of community, the importance of being with each other, of overlooking things that bother us about each other and spending more time focused on community. You know, we as a species survived because of community. That's one of the most powerful impulses we have in our makeups, or certainly our neuroscientific makeup. That's absolutely part of it. The caveman who decided he was going to go alone and wander off and be on his, he got eaten. We survived because of this intense need to be around others. Why? Because it helps us survive. We're easier to find food, divide the work more easily, you know, you get help when you're sick, et cetera, all these kinds of things. But in the last 40 years, certainly in America, we have decided that just simply community is too much work. It costs too much in taxes. It's a pain because I don't like the people I have to be around, on many, many reasons why. And we could go on for a full hour on all we have done in this country to destroy community in our areas. And I think what this epidemic is calling on us to do is return to that most potent force in our evolution and our survival. And that is community. And so as part of that, I decided what I have to do in this book, because I really believe that this was a big part of what was going on here, is what I had to do in the book was fill half of it. So half of the book, really, half the book is a very dour story of this drug problem that we have now. The other half, though, is filled with stories of people who very quietly, without notice and being unnoticed and non-sexy kind of stories of Americans involved in community repair that I could find. I just, for example, the guy from Muncie, Indiana, fellow named Bird, who lives in a neighborhood where the factories are falling apart and dying, really. The neighborhood's under great stress, partially from the opioid epidemic. The city's going to close the community center right across from his house where he used to work. And they cut the budget. And so they think the thing is closed, except Bird keeps the key. Bird keeps the key. And so the entire little neighborhood off down there in South Muncie, far from the city hall, when they know if they want to use the city community center, they just go find Bird. And he opens it up for the kids playing basketball, for the older folks playing cards, for wedding receptions. He mows the lawn, which is a big lawn out there. He fixes the toilets and so on. He does all this. He becomes a community center unto himself, helping this neighborhood that is going through such tension and such stress, helping it weather all that, you know, and he just does it on his own. It was these kinds of stories. There's a woman who was she's a retiree from corporate America. Her husband had died, left insurance money. She's been tutoring people in jail. She realizes tattoos are a big stumbling block for people who are trying to get back their lives back. She buys with the insurance money her husband left her a tattoo removal, laser tattoo removal machine, sets up a nonprofit and begins to laser remove the tattoos from people, including a brand that a woman had put on her by a pimp. Her pimp by her inner thigh, his name right there. She removes that kind of thing. Swastikas, teardrops, you know, all these kinds of tattoos. It's these kinds of stories that really fill half the book, because I wanted people to understand what I thought was the important message, was that we have the most potent force on our side, and we just had decided we didn't want to use it anymore, or it was too much hassle, or we don't know anybody anymore, so why go on? But human evolution has shown that community is how we survived, and we've gotten away from that in America in the last 40 years. So I wanted to highlight that, to say we have this power. Let's think of it, not to say that this is what, you know, not to provide a template for every county. This is the five things you need to do. No, it's really to say, think about ways in which you can make your community easier to live in, like the people whose stories I'm telling in half of the book.
We only have about 2 minutes left, and I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Will this problem get any better? Are there signs of hope besides what you were talking about, or is it going to take that sense of community? I noticed you didn't mention government there. About 90 seconds or less?
Well, I would say that there's a lot of things that government can do. I talk about how we need to rethink jail. I talk about drug courts. I talk also a little bit about how we need to establish with Mexico a very new kind of relationship that is blunt and forthright and deals with Mexican corruption, also deals with the guns that come from our country that are bought here very easily and smuggled south, ensuring all of that. Those kinds of things, the way it stands now, I would say that it's going to be very difficult. But I think that's the reason I wrote the book, to say, look, there are ways of moving forward on this, it seems to me. And others that other people may feel are well, good ideas as well. There's a lot of ideas out there, but it's going to take, yes, I think, a return to the idea that we're all in this together. We are only as strong as the most vulnerable. We are only as strong as the least of us.
Sam Quiñones, his new book, The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. Sam Quiñones, always good talking with you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
A real pleasure, Scott. Thank you very much.